Welcome, everyone. This is the weekly LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 16, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm going to give a correction to myself right away. This is for the November 16, 2013 LaRouche Show. But because of our guests who I'm going to introduce in just a moment and scheduling matters, we are pre-taping on Friday, November 15th. But with our topic as advertised, which is the following. We must heed Dr. Leo Alexander's warning. How Obamacare is already killing. It's killing the old and the poor. Now, to discuss this with us, I'm very glad we have a physician and scientist and I'm sure she will describe herself as a practitioner of the art of medicine, Dr. Kathy Helgeson, speaking with us from Chicago. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you very much. Hello.
And Kathy has had a long, fine career with a specialty in stroke, in neurology, in research, and we'll be hearing more about this in a few minutes. And speaking with us from Philadelphia, I welcome Steve Douglas. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Marcia.
And the Steve is in particular an associate, a longtime friend, I think, of the physician in Pennsylvania, Dr. Mark Shelley, who over the last year has been involved in putting forward the new paradigm we need for the economy, for science, for mankind. He spoke in New York City in January, and October 24th, Dr. Mark Shelley issued a call to other people, especially in the medical and civic sphere for public health and health care, to join him in Doctors Against Murderous Obamacare. So I want to just say a few things by way of introduction, and then we open the discussion with our guests, with Kathy and Steve. Because I mentioned that we're pre-taping today on Friday afternoon the 15th, and this is amidst the wildness taking place you may see on your television or computer screen in Washington, D.C., where there's all kinds of things. A vote was just taken to extend insurance because 5 million individuals have had their insurance policies canceled so far under the various mechanisms and rollout of Obamacare. I don't have to repeat the blatant dysfunction of the online computer sign-up called healthcare.gov, all that. But the point about all this is that right as we tape today, the president, I think, is meeting with the heads of the major private insurance companies that are involved in health insurance in the United States. Now, go back in time to 2009-2010, when the discussion was hot and heavy that eventuated in the March 2010 Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, we call Obamacare, there was every other day the private insurance companies were meeting with the White House or on the Hill with congressmen, because this is the point. If today there is apparent incessant discussion, how are we going to tweak private insurance to be able to work with anyone? This is like tweaking Wall Street for 500 years at least, going back to the financial networks based in Venice that controlled who lived and who died in the Mediterranean, banking for certain kinds of tyrants meant insurance for shipping. It meant other kinds of things like that over the ages, in Switzerland, in London, in Wall Street. And especially by 2009-2010, recall, it was already manifest to Americans and anyone else who didn't live under a rock that the entire monetary system was blowing out and financial bailouts were being wrongfully given to Wall Street and City of London famous names. And that's continuing up today. So what the hell, excuse my language, are we doing trying to figure out a system, how to figure out how healthcare should be given in collaboration with Wall Street? This is definitely Little Red Riding Hood meeting with the wolf. So I'm only saying that to get it out of the way. And initiate our discussion here about the reality that where citizens, where elected officials need to break ranks with outmoded partisan labels and identification, Republican, Democrat, North, South, whatever, whatever you want to say, is we have to break ranks on principle. And that's where we're in an emergency. We can do that. I want to say there's tremendous opportunity and positive shifts going on because people, just like there was a welling up and a rise up of public outcry against starting another, when President Obama announced he wanted to bomb Syria and start another war, and I think millions of people activated by email, phone, and everything else know. And right now there's a tremendous activation potential, and it's expressed in different ways. We might get into that or not, but we want to cut this crap. We need a new system here. No more bailouts, no more killing people in the name of bailouts to Wall Street via the private insurance sector. And so we should have what never should have been taken away, reintroduce the Glass-Steagall Act, which was in place for 60 years since 1933, even longer, to create the condition for real banking and credit and having infrastructure and projects and not backing up any of this speculative funny money, including insurance and health maintenance organization, that's a polite term for rip-offs and killing people, cut the crap. So I think that, I'll just throw in one anecdote. I think when the C-SPAN cable today was taking a poll saying, please call in, it might have been CNN, I don't know, during a vote that came up in the House of Representatives that anyone, individual who had lost his or her insurance should have the right to continue to have it to have it reinstated, if the insurance companies will do so. That's a whole other issue. Who knows what Wall Street wants to do? And many people who called in said, we think Obama should be impeached. Now, this wasn't a huge number, but this was not the times are changing by the hour, and so the leadership of people like we have here on the phone and that's come out of Pennsylvania, Kathy Helgeson, who's an activist in terms of Doctors Against Murders, Obamacare. This is going to make all the difference. Anyone listening now, I know many of you are active, and we don't want to, we just want to redouble in all focused directions and the opportunity, but on the other hand, the danger has never been greater. Now, with that said, let's open things up. Dr. Helgeson, that is Kathy from Illinois, can initiate the discussion here of what kind of mess we're in and say whatever you want about how we got here, Kathy.
Yes, I'd like to kind of give a short historical sweep over my career as a physician that led to the point where I really realized that the two big evils in this situation are money and mathematics. I started out my career in medical school in Iceland. We don't need to go into how that happened, but anyway, I went to medical school there and worked there for 2 years and had the benefits of seeing a system where money was not an issue at all. Anyone who was a resident or citizen of the country, if you got sick, you went into the hospital, there was no paperwork, there was nothing, and that was the end of the story. Then I did a residency here in this country, and this was the first time I really had it hit me in the face that, my God, you know, there were people getting not equal care here, and what was this? One of the hospitals that I had to rotate through had a huge ward of poor people, and the rest of the hospital had people in private rooms. And that was like, wow, what a difference from Iceland. What is this? And then finally, to crown my residency off, I had a medical ethicist walk up to me and say, you know, you order too many tests. Do you know that that's unethical? Because if you order a test and the patient can't pay for it, that's unethical. So this was totally foreign to me because I had been trained to go after the cause of the problem, figure out what the process of curing the problem was, and that was the focus. Money had never entered into the equation, and suddenly this guy, you know, threw in this nasty little twist, calling me unethical because if I tried to solve the problem but the person couldn't pay for my solving the problem, I was the one who was unethical. So sweep forward a few years, I became an academic neurologist, and as an academic neurologist, you're expected to publish and do research and be productive in the number of patients you take, not the number of patients, but how you take care of your patients and how you gain a reputation for being a good doctor. And then suddenly, out of the blue, comes this measure of productivity. What is the measure of productivity expected of you? Guess what? How much money you bring in.
Oh, to your institution, you mean?
Yes. Mm. So that suddenly came in. Money again. All right. Then this was around the same time that all of these HMOs started. The case managers came up to the floor telling us to get our patients out of the hospital. The hospital wasn't going to get paid. And so it all goes on and on up until this two-midnight rule that we now have, which is patient admissions to the hospital, the level of care that the patient is going to be put into will depend on whether or not they're going to spend two midnights in the hospital or not. I mean, totally divorced from the problem at hand, you know? And so that's one aspect of the money issue. The other one is the math, how this evidence-based medicine intruded itself into the situation. This all started around the same time, I would say, that the productivity issue popped up. And this would be, and I don't know if I'm right, but I would say probably mid-90s. So maybe somebody on the phone call knows what happened in the mid-90s. But suddenly, we were being told, as physicians, and especially as specialists, that not only did we order too many tests, but our decision-making process was not scrutable. And the only way to make it scrutable or transparent was to intrude mathematics into this. And so math took the form, or the math that was chosen was probability-based statistics. Well, of course, the focus of that is chance, right? Mm-hmm. And physicians were then told that, well, whatever outcome they... See, I'm even using the verbiage, which
outcome.
I don't want to use.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to their patient, it was just by chance. They really had no control over it. Mm. So this, you know, kept being pushed and pushed and pushed until medical societies judged you, whether or not you would be relicensed, on whether or not you practiced evidence-based medicine. Do you practice medicine based on the results of large statistical studies? Do you know? And finally, it's gotten to the point where at the bedside, when you're making rounds with medical students, the question now has become not what's wrong with the patient, what's the process that's going on here, and what is the process we have to go through to change the future of this patient for the better. The question is, what are the chances that the patient has this or that? What are the chances that this or that will work? They're two different questions. They're two completely different questions. Because when a physician asks, what are the chances, he's gambling with the future of the patient. And that is how I think math has really destroyed this thought process. It's removed the physician from the actual individual pathophysiology of the disease process and the physiology, or, you know, of the cure. So you're no longer on a one-to-one with the patient. You're, you know, dealing with statistical results that are far removed from this individual problem at hand. And this all has to do with, you know, the concept of causation, and I guess a brainwashing of the physicians to become to believe that they can't cause anything. to happen or not happen, because we live in a world of chance, and there is no connection between what the physician does and the future of the patient. And so anybody actually, you know, could practice medicine, you know, if they just go by paint the numbers from the statistical trials, is the idea being, you know, pushed on us. So I think it's come pretty far. I mean, because I just see it every day in my practice, the way people are, you know, their brains are being twisted. Even mine, you know, I even use the word outcome, you know. It's like it's intruded itself.
Yeah, instead of, did the person recover? Are they healthy? Are
they, right.
How are they doing? Are they doing all right? No. What is the measurable outcome statistically?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me continue, or otherwise, let me just throw in here for your listeners, and then we can go to Steve. But you mentioned, when you fast-forwarded to the present time, this thing that's got this nickname, Two Midnights, for the reasons you just said, regarding rules that came into effect October 1st. I just want our listeners to know that, regarding strictures on admissions policies for Medicare patients, probably Medicaid too, I can't remember, but Medicare in the hospitals, that so that they restrict any judgment of the physician involved, some of the labs, some of the testing people, the caring people, where if you're a clear-cut case and stay longer than two midnights, the hospital and the others involved get paid as Medicare inpatient fees. Whereas anything less than that can be called outpatient. It's much less pay to everyone involved. It's that money thing again. And it's also, this particular thing called the Two Midnight Policy is one of at least a dozen, 15 outrageous, newly imposed, since last year under Obamacare and under the Obama administration, even if it isn't in the 2010 Act, kinds of ways where hospitals aren't being paid, physicians will be docked financially and not paid if they don't follow the new rules of all different kinds. I'm going to spare you mentioning some of them. We're putting them on LaRouche Political Action Committee. They're in EIR. But this is an onslaught, right, Kathy?
Oh, I really believe it is, because as a physician, when you take on a patient who is facing, you know, hospital admission, what's going through your head is, what is going to happen to this patient? What could happen to this patient? How serious is this problem? Not, how long do I think this patient is going to stay? How much do I think I'm going to get, or the hospital's going to get reimbursed for this, or will they get reimbursed for this? I mean, it's just like a total diversion from reality of what needs to be done.
Right, and I assure you, I've watched hours and hours for certain reasons of responsibility of these debates on Capitol Hill about the insurance. And, of course, the insurance is, it's outrageous. People have no insurance. They show up. They get a bill for $15,000. So this is a problem. But this, just what you were describing, the actual reality of, is care going to be given? Is there going to be the means to deliver care? Are doctors going to be allowed to doctor? Is the hospital going to remain open? That's where we're at. So do you want to take it up from there, Steve, and we can keep going?
Yeah, sure, sure. When Dr. Shelley launched his initiative for Doctors Against Murderous Obamacare, he cited the essay that Dr. Leo Alexander wrote for the New England Journal of Medicine that appeared in the July 1949 edition of the New England Journal of Medicine. And this essay on medical science under dictatorship is a chilling look at what the roots of what became the genocide perpetrated by the Nazis were. And what Dr. Alexander was doing was spotlighting that the roots of this worst ever genocide in history up until that time, that this, the roots had small beginnings in the euthanasia movement in Germany in the late 30s that operated on the idea of a life not worthy to be lived. But he went back before that and he said, really, the problem in German medicine was something called Hegelian utilitarianism. That the question was functionality. The issue is, can you as a doctor make this person sufficiently mobile that he can do work for the state, that he can do work for society? And the premium was on the question of not money as such, but resources, money in its day, but with a few twists. So what Dr. Alexander was concerned about was what he saw in, even in 1949, was the tendencies that had already crept into American medicine, even in the aftermath of the Nuremberg tribunals, where all the horror of what had happened, partially it related to medicine in and medical practice in Germany, and otherwise the mass genocide beyond that. He was horrified to see that some of the same kinds of thinking that operated in Germany in 1938, 1939 in the P4 euthanasia program were already evident in the United States. And so he talked about how does the doctor think, what did the medical community do under circumstances of a dictatorship? And as Dr. Shelley was reading this material from Leo Alexander, he was stunned at the realization that what we're operating under in the United States is a kind of monetary dictatorship that has been imposed upon medicine, which is what Obamacare is. It's everything is done according to cost and utility. The question of the well-being of the patient is not fundamental any longer. And Dr. Alexander pointed out that really what had happened in Germany was the doctors began to think about, is this person really rehabilitatable? If they're chronically ill and they're not going to be able to recover fully, well, let's call that a second-class patient, and let's not give that patient the treatment. The kind of thing that you were talking about, Kathy, with the people of lower income, the two sections of the hospital, what you described as seeing in the United States is exactly what Dr. Alexander was warning against and said was already beginning to happen. So you have a situation where Dr. Alexander was sounding the alarm, and he did investigations into how could doctors who had taken the Hippocratic Oath, who had gone to medical school with the idea that they were going to help improve the health of their patients and the society generally, how could they be swept up into a system that was committing mass murder? If initially in small beginnings in the euthanasia movement, small beginnings so-called, how could they be swept up into this? And he said, look, doctors, many doctors who were involved in the killing because they were fearful of reprisals or they were fearful of ostracism. And what they did was they adapted to the system. And so even if they weren't injecting poisonous substances into somebody, they were part of what they recognized to be a killing system. Even if they tried to save one patient or another, they adapted to this system once this concept of Hegelian utilitarianism took full root. So Dr. Alexander was sounding the alarm about this, and what Dr. Shelley's been talking about is, look, if you're practicing medicine today, under the circumstances that we're confronted with, in point of fact, you're being told that you have to kill people. You're being told if you follow the rules, and if they die, it's not your fault. You're following the rules. The rules come first, not the health of the people. You mentioned one case recently that particularly troubled him. It just happened a couple weeks ago. One of his patients, an 86-year-old man who was in great health and cutting cords of wood every year, vibrant health, he started to get shortness of breath. And he went, Dr. Shelley looked at him and said, look, let's get you to the hospital. The initial diagnosis was pneumonia. They put him into intensive care. He was taken care of there for several days, but he didn't get any better. So what they did, instead of intensifying the treatment, because he didn't get any better, the protocol called for him to be moved into what they call a swing bed, which is kind of a nursing-type facility within the hospital that represents a lower level of care, since he wasn't responding to treatment. Of course, he's 86 years old, so what's his life expectancy? So that's one strike against him. That's the major strike against him. So the gentleman got less care in the swing bed, and he died within days of congestive heart failure. And Dr. Shelley was just crushed. He was horrified that this is what the system dictates. If they're that old and they have a problem, let's not spend a lot of money. And then you don't have somebody putting them in a gas chamber, but you have parts of the hospital system that are facilitating killing centers. And you see this on a broad scale, obviously, in Greece and in Cyprus and other areas where you have a more advanced phase of breakdown. But we're very close to that right here, right now. Dr. Shelley felt that he could not practice medicine any longer and be faithful to his Hippocratic oath if he didn't speak out in this way and put himself forward, calling upon other doctors to join him, overcome the fear of ostracism, overcome the fear of professional blackballing, or overcome the fear of your creditors if you have bills built up for medical school payments and so on and so forth. This has to be stopped. And that's why he said we have to restore the Hippocratic Oath. But then what the other two points are, what's needed is to immediately restore Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. All of the resources that should be going into the hospital system and our healthcare system and educational system are being sucked into Wall Street and these gigantic speculation schemes, and it's literally responsible for mass murder. And he also called the third point in his perspective is impeach Obama. Impeach Obama. He's already committed impeachable crimes. We have to move him to one side. So Dr. Shelley spoke at our conference back in January in New York on the question of monetization of medicine, and gave a speech which was outlined in EIR in a recent issue. But he sees that the situation is degenerating so rapidly that he felt he had to take this initiative and mobilize the additional forces that can get Glass-Steagall and they can get Obama impeached. He will be down in Washington next week, next Tuesday. He'll be working with the LaRouche representatives on the Hill for a number of meetings, and hopefully that'll help fuel the process that can get Glass-Steagall enacted and Obama impeached in the very near term. But that's a summary of where we stand with him.
Right. Well, Kathy, at this point, do you want to add more on this situation of the strictures? You can't treat, you can't doctor, please do.
Yes, I just wanted to say don't underestimate how this evidence-based medicine has undermined this whole situation here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the whole scientific community in medicine has been taken over by probability-based statistics, right? So you have physicians now being told that they have to practice according to the, statistical results. So you know, a therapy that may only work in 20% of patients and doesn't work in 80% is not going to be used. Let's say you have a miracle drug for cancer, right, but it only works in 20%. Because it doesn't work in 80%, you're being told you can't use that drug, or you're being given a hell of a lot of grief if you try to, you know. Instead, you have to practice, you have to leave it to chance, right? What's going to happen to your patient? I mean, this is a real undermining of, it's a dumbing down, you know, of the whole process. It goes back to the well, caring for the well-being of the patient. As a physician, you want to do absolutely everything you can to help the patient, to interrupt the disease process, to, you know, create a good future for that patient. And you can't do it when you're, you know, being told you have to make the choice based on statistics. It's a big deal, this.
Yeah, let me throw in here. I guess we have some music in the background, but we can live with that.
No, I'm sorry. It's my phone going off, and I don't know how to turn it off.
Oh,
so.
That's all right. Well, we're happy to have you live. You stay live now, Kathy.
Okay, I will.
And I just want to tell people before the hour's out, you can see Kathy Helgeson has various pieces published on what she's warning and talking about. But if you go to 21st Century, the site for 21st Century Science and Technology magazine, the e-journal now, look, you can put in her name, and that's like a Scandinavian son of Helga, H-E-L-G-A-S-O-N, Helgeson.
Right.
Kathy. It happens to be in 2006 is one called How Statistics Fail Medicine, The Strange Case of Aspirin, in which you go through this, that for a certain amount of people it doesn't work, but you want to know who test for who it does and who it doesn't work for, etc. But that's in 21st Century Science and Technology, and otherwise put her name in, and there are other articles, but that's one in particular.
Well, Kathy, I'd like to respond to the comments you've made so far on the question of the warped use of language and the hideous implications of the application of statistics to the whole medical profession. It means mass death.
Yes.
Look at it from the standpoint. Leo Alexander addressed this in his essay back in 49 when he said, he actually looked at the way this euthanasia process worked, because they disguised it. The people at the top were disguising it. So what they did was they solicited questionnaires, and an institution called the Realms Work Committee of Institutions for Cure and Care
being interviewed on the radio
distributed questionnaires throughout all the medical institutions in Germany. And every doctor had to fill out forms for his patients. Then these forms were collected and sent to teams of professors of psychiatry, basically experts, who would then review the questionnaires and see which people met which category of requirements for either possible rehabilitation, or that they were determined in looking at the questionnaires, they determined these people won't be rehabilitatable, in which case they would order the euthanasia. Now, this is mind-boggling. In the case of one person, one expert, between November 14th and December 1st, 1940, 17 days, reviewed 2,109 questionnaires while serving as a full-time professor of psychiatry.
Oh.
So they weren't reviewing anything. This was a statistical genocide. Now then, once they determined who should be taken away, what they had was they established a Realms Committee for Scientific Approach to Severe Illness Due to Heredity and Constitution. That's the name of the organization that actually did the killing. Then the name of the institution that took the people from the institution to the killing centers was the Charitable Transport Company for the Sick. That was the name of it.
For the vans and things, you mean?
And then, yeah, that's right, the vans.
In Limburg.
The way they paid for it was they established what they called a charitable foundation for institutional care. And they sent people out to collect the cost of the having killed these people from the relatives that survived. And what they did was they said, we're sorry for your loss. They lied about how the people died. And they said, here are the unpaid charges for their final days. We expect you to meet the bill. So this kind of monstrous activity under the guise of these kinds of either innocuous statistical correlations, supposedly, or these algorithms they have today. If you, Dr. Shelley was talking about, well, if somebody expects that you don't have more than 10 years to live, then you're not supposed to give somebody a colonoscopy. Well, how do you determine that the person is not going to have 10 years to live? Once they get to 75, then you don't give it to them, et cetera, et cetera. Or you will be penalized if you do. So you have this this hideous assault on any concept of humanity that's inherent in the kind of thing that you're talking about with statistics and was practiced by these Nazis and their collaborators in the German medical community in 38, 39, and so on. And Dr. Alexander went through this in excruciating detail, and you can see that's what we have now. They called Obamacare, and it's you could say it's Obamakill. The death rates are going to go up, and the people that put this together know it. The point that Mr. LaRouche has been making all along is that it's intended to kill. That the people at the top that are running Wall Street from the Anglo-Dutch financial center in London and so on and so forth, they intend to reduce the world's population from 6 billion to 1 to 2 billion, and they're going to do it by cutting health care, food production, and so on. And what we see is the manifestation of this in these kinds of practices. So this is murder, but it's murder with a the cover of innocuous names, statistical arrays. It's murder by statistics. It's murder by deception, and people end up looking for the wrong thing. They say, "Is it going to be gas ovens again? How about just open-air mass killing in Greece?"
Well, the interesting thing I think about this is, again, being naive, I thought, oh, I'm going to make this the focus of my research. And we proved over and over again there is no way the statistics can be extrapolated to the individual case.
Mm-hmm.
No way. No way does statistics address the issue of causation, which is a process
mm-hmm.
that occurs between things and is hidden. It's not a dot, to be counted. We've over and over again, and I would go to my colleagues and I'd say, this is, look at what we, what we showed. This. They say, we don't care. They don't care. They don't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care and they don't want to hear it. And somebody must have wanted to hear it because we had papers published, but nonetheless, it's like, shut up, go away, We don't want to, What was I told? Keep your nose clean.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, if you want to say something, Steve, but before the hour's out, Kathy, mm-hmm. I wonder if you would tell Steve and people about this. You identified this one assault on really dealing with the patients, with individuals that occurs upon admission to a hospital. And you describe as a person who may be presenting, you did this, with some stroke symptoms or something else, how this two-midnight atrocity works, which is to really cut care, save money, and kill people. But describe how it ought to work, how it worked in the old days, how it's working now since October 1st.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember the case that you're talking about.
You said a person came in, a man, I'm saying this because it struck me, Because remember, this is new, it's underway, and I'll just preface this again. I'll tell you, such as it is, the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association last Friday wrote letters, this has to stop. This is, you said, say a man comes in on the left side of his face is numb, and then what you would do, but what now you can't keep him for observation and so forth, that kind of thing.
Oh, no, I remember what I said.
Okay, please.
Yeah, patient presents with dizziness and staggering and has neck pain. And, you know, as a stroke neurologist, I know what that can mean. That could mean that he's having a vertebral artery dissection. That means a, you know, a tear in the artery leading to the back part of the brain called the brainstem. And that this could cause a major stroke. In fact, it could cause him to be paralyzed in all four limbs and locked in for the rest of his life. But he hasn't shown any definitive signs on his exam. So basically what this person needs is, you know, 24-hour, very close monitoring for, and, you know, it's an extensive workup for this. And because the physicians who see the patient in the ER don't understand necessarily what the implications of this particular set of symptoms are, and are forced to say, well, we can't guarantee this guy's going to spend two midnights in the hospital. The patient gets put, instead of in the hospital as an inpatient, which is the highest intensity of level of monitoring, they get put in kind of a ratcheted down, almost swing bed type situation, as you were describing it, which is totally inadequate for monitoring a patient like this. But the question that the physicians in the emergency room are being forced to ask is not what could happen to this patient, right? It's will they spend two midnights in the hospital? I mean, it has nothing to do with anything medical.
Right.
And that could kill this guy. I mean, this guy could develop symptoms and signs that would be totally unnoticed for 8 hours or 6 hours or whatever the monitoring is, you know, on the ratcheted down floor, as opposed to, you know, every two-hour monitoring.
Yes, Kathy was pointing out in the old days, or some days,
yes,
you would want some long ago, but you
right.
might be specific about it, and some people have experience or not. You might want to make sure that the patient gets in a bed near the nurse's station, making it easy on them. They'll want to do it there, right?
Right. I mean, in the old days, first of all, this patient could be put in an intensive care unit bed, you know, but in the old days, they might go to a floor, but you'd move them close to the nurse's station where they would be monitored all the time. But no, you know, ratcheted down.
So you could say, I mean, since just October 1st and the implementation of this, you're getting a death count now. You may not be out there with the statistician's notebook taking notes down and entering it in e-records, but it is happening. Go ahead.
What strikes me is that this two midnight policy is a murderous variation on exactly what Dr. Alexander was talking about in terms of the problem of the concept of the non-rehabilitatable sick.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what you're doing is, instead of saying, well, this person might not last, you know, beyond the person doesn't have a good prognosis, he might not live another 10 years. He might not live another 5 years. He's got a chronic problem, whatever. Now what they're saying is if it's not two nights, then we're going to accelerate the whole process. They've redefined who's going to get care and who's not in a way which vastly expands the pool of targets, if you will.
But you see, again, it's money. It all has to do
exactly.
with money. It has to do with whether or not the hospital will get paid.
What Dr. Shelley was talking about the other day was an interesting discussion. He said, doctors are taught about triage. You know, if you're a medic in a combat situation and you have four soldiers that are wounded. One's nearly at death's door with arterial bleeding and so on. Two are badly wounded but might be saved, and the other is bruised. How are you going to, you have only moments. What's the criterion that you use to figure out what you, how you want to deploy yourself? He said the principle is save the maximum number of lives. That's what he was taught. He said what's happened now is that instead of saving the maximum number of lives, medicine is being told, doctors are being told to save the maximum number of dollars. And in the name of this monetary dictatorship, people are being hastened to their death because there's money in it. So this is every bit as horrific as anything that that Dr. Alexander was warning about back in 49.
Yes, woe unto you if you're statistically unclear, according to Kathy. You present at the hospital and you're in one of these statistically unclear categories, right, Kathy?
Well, I haven't heard it said out loud like that, but I mean, that is the way it is. What are the chances, yeah, you know, that the patient has this? What are the chances there'll be two midnights in the hospital?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, yeah, a total disconnect with the causal process of the disease and the cure. Totally, a total disconnect.
And the spirit of medicine goes out the window. I mean, the spirit of the Hippocratic Oath. The thing that Leo Alexander was saying was that what needed to be revived was the spirit of treating people, of nurturing their spirit, the totality of their being, not simply to treat them as a commodity, some of which are fixable and some of which aren't. And at this point, the only way you can address something like this is through the kind of perspective that LaRouche has been talking about, which requires the change in the system as a whole. Glass-Steagall is the way to go, because that's what will break the back of this financial stranglehold that Wall Street and its friends from London have and are exercising over the United States right now. If these banks that are too big to fail could no longer suck the life out of the medical system and billions out of Medicare, Medicaid, hospitals, and so on, we'd be in a completely different universe. And if we at the same time said that we're going to hold Obama accountable for his actions in this situation, and people got serious about the impeachment question in the way that Marcia, you were referring to that earlier from C-SPAN and so on, we could get somewhere very quickly. I will say that one thing that that has struck Dr. Shelley in all of this is how happy and relieved and grateful most people are that he has spoken out in the way that he has. He's been, Dr. Shelley has been, I wouldn't say overwhelmed, but at certain points close to it, by how deeply, deeply grateful people have been coming up to him on the street, coming up to people that they didn't know knew him. His neighbor was in a convenience store the other day, and a trucker started talking to him about Dr. Shelley's initiative. He had read about it in the newspaper, and they're standing in line in a convenience store, and the one guy strikes up a discussion with a person he didn't know was Dr. Shelley's next-door neighbor about how grateful he was that a doctor would take this kind of initiative, and it took a lot of courage. Some of Dr. Shelley's patients have come in and said, "Doctor, we're worried about you. We're worried that the government might come after you. You know, what can we do to help protect you? You have to take care of yourself," that kind of thing. I mean, that's how deeply affected people are by this question. And the fact that LaRouche has taken the initiative to give a perspective for a solution, not only for this country, but for the globe, from the standpoint of this Glass-Steagall initiative, is vital. But people know that the problem is big enough, and it's pervasive enough, but they see glimmers of a solution, that if we mobilize ourselves effectively, we could rally these people to actually bring about this change. There's been a lot of things this week. Bill Clinton spoke out for the first time in a while.
Yeah, if you want to say more on that, Steve, please go ahead.
Why don't you go ahead?
No, I want anything you feel. I mean, you mentioned, I forget it was Monday or Tuesday, you said that Bill Clinton said, well, it should be that if the president misspoke and said everyone can keep in their insurance, he better change it so they can keep their insurance, right?
Yeah. And now the momentum is such that we could change things axiomatically. One of the dangers, I think, in this situation is that sometimes, you know, people can get carried away with a little piece of the pie, I want to fix this part of the system. The system itself is rotten. The system from the top, with this Wall Street dictatorship, is designed to kill. And it's infected the entirety of our medical system. And that's what's dangerous. So we got to take it from the top and not, try to fix something that's not fixable within the system. This is why I think Dr. Shelley's seen a number of doctors leaving practice. People that were going to, he knew that 5 years ago, said they were going to practice for another, 10 or 15 years. A number of them are getting out now, at the end of the year, and he hears more and more about this all the time. Because, I mean, like you're saying, Kathy, doctors aren't allowed to practice medicine.
Yeah.
And a good doctor knows that when they can't practice medicine, then they're party to something else. They're party to something which is non-medicine, and which is obviously can be lethal. It's, in fact, to the extent that it takes medicine out of the picture, is designed to be lethal.
And it's not as if there's not a solution there. Number one, Glass-Steagall, and number two, you have the Conyers bill.
Yeah.
Which throws money out the window.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. If the solution is there, if we were to get Glass-Steagall and change the system from the top down, this is a nice little thing that fits in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, people should look it up if they haven't. I think it's 676, H.R. 676. For, you could call it Medicare for All, you could call it, you can read it, but it's like the Veterans Affairs system for, you come, you get treated, and cut out the everything in between that now is you don't get treated.
Yeah, it's if you can excuse my language, cut out the crap, It cuts all of this stupidity out of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It actually creates a beautiful future for medicine were it to be adopted.
And people can give thought. We're going to have you on again on other aspects of this, but think of building up instead of what has to be shut down. There are whole counties, Western Florida, that have no baby doctor for the women, who have no certain orthopedic physicians. They've lost their mammography units. You can't get a breast cancer scan unless you drive 200 miles in parts of the High Plains. I mean, this system is coming down very fast. You're in a metro area, Kathy. I don't know if you have something specific, but I know your state of Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa, Kansas, these states have had a first line of defense from the 1990s. They call it critical access hospitals, that were paid in full for Medicare and other reimbursement, just so that they would stay open for any kind of treatment. Well, under the Obama administration in August, it was announced, of these 1,300 hospitals nationwide, the Obama administration wants to redefine them, so 849 of them may go out of existence. So just what Steve said, this is an issue and a half, but to fight it is merely a single issue, which 20 senators, Republicans and Democrats, are fighting it. And you can get other issues, like the two-midnight issue or the other issues, the not having any insurance, 5 million people. But we've got to have the take it from the top and deal with the system. But I turn it back over to you in the remaining minutes. Each of you, you can whichever one jump in for any point you want to re-stress or add.
Well, I just mentioned something that Dr. Shelley was discussing the other day. The QE3 each month, $84.5 billion or more is being pumped into the portfolios of these banks to go nowhere but back up this rotten speculative portfolio. Think about, he said, well, think about the Apollo program. The space program spent between 1959 and 1973 a total of $20.5 billion.
Huh.
And in 2010 dollars, that's $110 billion. So you got six lunar landings, a revolution in technology. What we've been able to do with satellites to advance global agriculture has been astounding, and so on and so forth. There were so many multiplier effects of the kind of scientific leading-edge technology that came from the Apollo program that radiated through the economy. Think about that. For one and a half or one and a third months of QE3, you could fund the entire Apollo program all over again. Think about what you could do with medicine. Think about what you could do to revive the medical system. If we have Glass-Steagall, those are the kinds of things that we can undertake, freeing ourselves up from this this murderous bubble.
Yeah, I think at the beginning I said get money and math out of medicine. It's more like get money and genocide out of medicine.
Exactly. And you could say that statistics is the language of genocide.
There you go.
Right. And I'm thinking of nuclear medicine and what we ought to be doing. That's a whole other discussion. We only have a few minutes left. But, Kathy, I'm thinking of your husband's lifelong interest. He is deceased. We appreciate his contribution. But he was a virologist, and now the world of microbes is waiting to invade, right? I just got dengue fever has been identified in Houston, Texas.
No.
Cholera in the Caribbean, polio in the Midwest. But do you want to, it's funny, but this isn't funny, it's grim. But what we could be doing in the way that Steve just described, you must have a personal sense of it too, right, Kathy?
Well, I mean, obviously I realize that this is only going to grow as the, you know, population of the poor who can't afford to get, you know, to get vaccinated is growing. And, you know, people who think that they're going to be able to escape this are really fools.
You know? There's the math of, the mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe, right? Who those who think we can draw up the drawbridge with gated medicine or concierge medicine or, right?
Right, exactly. I unfortunately know many people who think that they can escape this. Mm-hmm. They have no concept what they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, would you kindly draw things to close? I want you to actually make a pitch. You've had the Pennsylvania media and Indo-Ohio and other parts of the country have been very responsive, right, to republish as a letter to the editor or in other or as an article, right, Mark Shelley's call. Could you mention that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think we've had his statement launching Doctors Against Murderous Obamacare has been reprinted in full in about 10 newspapers in Pennsylvania and Ohio. And the response that we've gotten from people is just fantastic. And you can see that in some cases, somebody was getting this 10 emails down the road. So many people, it's rocketing all over the country. But I'll say one thing, which is interesting in terms of the one of the newspapers, I believe it was in Meadville. The newspapers reserve for themselves the right to put whatever title they want on an op-ed.
The headline, huh?
Yeah, that's right. So they can put whatever headline they want. So the newspaper in Meadville, Dr. Shelley's title is Doctors Against Murderous Obamacare. The newspaper in Meadville, and some of them have run that, the newspaper in Meadville said, impeach Obama before it's too late to save this country. And so that was the title that the editorial page editor chose to put on it. And that just shows you how hot that things are. That, 6 months ago, a year ago, when LaRouche was talking about impeaching Obama, and longer, people said, oh, that's too extreme. Now you have various state newspapers in rural America taking the initiative to put the spotlight on the need to impeach Obama. Lynn, in his latest statement on the horrors of Weimar, and that we're beyond Weimar in terms of the danger that we face right now, made the point: Obama has to go. We have to get people to take the step on impeachment, and things are so politically hyper mobilized at this point that there's a good chance that we can do it, provided we keep the focus on Glass-Steagall and impeachment from the top, and don't get distracted on particulars or certain features of the situation, no matter how compelling they might be.
Well, the time flew by, but that's definitely the point to end on. Namely, we're giving orders, we're not lobbying, and now the time is now. So I want to thank you, Steve Douglas, in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, and Dr. Kathy Helgeson in Chicago. And this will be the end of the LaRouche Show. It is November 16, 2013. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.